I'd like to welcome you to this evening's forum panel. The title of this forum is Please Leave Me Alone. Is that what it is? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Please Leave Me Alone, varying viewpoints on euthanasia. And just some guidelines so you understand what tonight's about. Forums are a time for the community to express their opinions and be hopefully received graciously from each other. It's a time where we encourage dissension, argument, in a sense of care and compassion for further understanding. Tonight it's a little bit different because we do have three members on our panel, and with that, what we want to do is have each of them, after they introduce themselves, we have a case study I will read. They are going to reflect on that case study from each of their perspectives. Then we will ask you as a community if you want any questions of clarification or pointed questions, just so we can understand the case from each of their perspectives a little bit better before you want to address and make your opinion statements. And after we really have the case in hand and where they stand on the case and other issues that may arise out of it, then we'll throw it open for whatever sort of comments you may want to make and take issue with each other or with any of our panel guests. We have with us here Roger Harms, who's a physician at the in Rochester. It is Granger Westberg. I got to tell you this. Somebody came up to me and says, "What kind of ranger is he anyway?" his name is Granger Westberg, and does that have something to do with? No, I'll leave it there. And then we also have D.D. Bechtel, who is an attorney. And I'd like each of them just briefly do a little more introduction, telling about their background and why they may be qualified to speak on a topic like euthanasia.
Okay. Well, yes, I'm Roger Harms. I am a physician, an obstetrician gynecologist by specialty at Rochester, Minnesota. And issues of life and death come up to an obstetrician gynecologist more than you might originally think. And thus I have had a lot of interest. I've had no special training in ethics or in theology. But a rather profound interest in how I am having to deal with these issues in day-to-day life in practice. And I'd consider only my experience in practice and the thoughts that I've had reflecting on that as my entire qualification for being on the panel.
I'm Ranger Westbrook.
And the lone one?
In the old days, they used to kid me I was Granger Rough Cut, but none of you young people would know what that was. That was a tobacco. I was a parish pastor and just happened by some fluke to spend a week in a hospital and eventually became a chaplain there. I hadn't been a chaplain more than a week, I think, when two young doctors came into my office and they said, "Could we talk to you about a problem we've got? We've got an old man, 87 years old, who's dying of cancer of the throat. He's in terrible pain all the time, and we just feel so badly for him. But now he has pneumonia. Should we try to cure the pneumonia?" And that was the question that we began with. And that type of thing came up over and over again. Pneumonia used to be called, and still is called, the old man's friend. And so my natural reaction was to say, well, you're concerned about this man, and now the old man's friend is with him. Let the old man do the job. And they said, "You mean as a minister you're telling us we should let him die?" And I said, "I guess that's the way I feel about it." And so with that, we'll pass on to the next person.
I'm Dee Bechtel. I'm a lawyer in private practice. I assist people in writing wills and living wills. And I think later on, when we get into the case study, we can talk a little more about living wills and their validity and their enforcement in various places. Before I went to law school, which was 6 years ago, I worked at a hospital. I was an administrative assistant at Seaside General Hospital, Seaside, Oregon. And there confronted various issues like patients' rights and what hospitals' policies are in terms of what rights patients have and what they don't have. And so that was probably the beginning of my concern with the patient's point of view. But then, of course, then my legal training shed some more light on that as well. That's enough to begin.
I can't remember if I introduced myself, just in case I didn't. I'm Darius Larson. I'm the village philosopher up here for at least another 4 days or 3 days, and then I'm going back to the University of New Mexico, where I'm the campus pastor. The case study is a brief one, two paragraphs. Our doctor said that we should change the initials of the doctor because it's the same as his, but I'm not going to do that. Here it is. As head nurse of the hospital ward, you have gathered together the other nurses to meet with the surgeon caring for Mr. T.S. 2 years ago, at age 71, Mr. T.S. underwent colostomy for colon cancer and then underwent x-ray therapy when the cancer reoccurred. Now blood tests suggest that the cancer has moved from the colon to the liver. While often drowsy, Mr. T.S. has nevertheless communicated to various nurses that he realizes he is approaching the terminal state. He is tired of medical procedures and wishes that they would just, quote, leave me alone. You have called a conference to deal with the nurses' dissatisfactions over the surgeon's plan to treat Mr. T.S. aggressively with radiation and surgical procedures. The surgeon, Dr. H., admits that the patient is terminal and that cure is impossible, and that death will occur within several months, even with aggressive therapy. Still, he argues, quote, if we take it upon ourselves to end his life before then, we are playing God. Who gives us that right? And how would we feel if the week after he died, somebody discovered the cure for cancer? I've been brought up to believe that human life is sacred and we ought to do anything possible to preserve it. End quote, end case number 17.
I get the dubious honor of starting out on this. Well, like I said, I don't claim to have answers. I mostly have questions. And I think to embellish the question somewhat, I can tell you a little bit about what Mr. T.S. is probably...
Little louder.
Okay. What Mr. T.S. has probably been through up to this point. First of all, colon cancer, what he's suffering from, is a very common condition. And this case study is by no means an uncommon clinical situation. I would hazard to say that I'd almost guarantee that these thoughts are going through the mind of hundreds of people as we talk tonight, because colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death. It's a very common condition. And so Mr. T.S. probably went to his physician a couple years ago with problems of either rectal bleeding or constipation or something on that order, underwent x-ray tests that showed that he had a colon cancer, and the appropriate treatment for that is usually surgical. And when the tumor involves such a low portion of the colon that it can't be sewn back together again, a colostomy is brought out to the abdominal wall, which means that the patient no longer has bowel movements in the normal fashion, but it comes out into a bag on the abdominal wall. This can be controlled in a fairly reasonable fashion, but it's certainly a change in his life. The second thing, judging from what came forth, was that probably at the time of the original operation, the tumor must have been fairly well advanced. Because since then, he's already had one local recurrence. I say local because it was treated with radiation therapy. And radiation therapy only works in a specific area you're aiming the x-rays at. So so it must have been a fairly local recurrence. Now that has failed, and he has showed up with blood test changes that suggest that the tumor is now in the liver, and that is a common pre-terminal event in colon cancer. Now, from the physician's point of view, we have taken an oath, which I don't think affects this decision all that much, but I think it is interesting to reflect upon, that the Hippocratic oath that everybody says at the time of medical school graduation is that you will preserve life, that is your ultimate goal in the profession. Now, I don't think that Hippocrates, when this was put down, had in mind the technological problems that we run into in 1984, but nevertheless, that is what you're in the business to do. And it's sometimes hard to change gears. And our physician in this case is having a very hard time to change gears. The other thing is that many cases, patients are saying things like, why don't you just leave me alone? A long time before we're at the medical level that Mr. T.S. is, where they don't fully understand the potential benefits to the particular therapy that is being suggested. And this can sometimes go for the nursing staff also, who is bringing up this question. So that, as I read this case, it initially seems rather open and shut. I would never use the argument that I don't want to play God and therefore I will try to prolong someone's life. I think there's just as much argument that you're playing God by doing that as the other way around. But at the same time, I can relate to the physician's feelings of not wanting to admit defeat, always wanting to hold before the patient some kind of hope, which is a key to terminal care in general, to always give the patient some reason to have hope and not to destroy hope, and therefore trying to think of some other therapy that might be offered. So though I would not handle the case the way the doctor here is, I can appreciate his thought process. I guess I'll just put it that way.
As I think about this particular case, I naturally feel right away that we're dealing with a case that would go to the hospice type program. And I presume you all know of hospice. It's brand new in the sense that it's only about 7 or 8 years old, and yet it is sweeping the country. But in certain hospitals, we've had great difficulty getting the doctors to approve of it for the very reasons that this doctor doesn't want to stop the treatment. But you notice he's saying to the nurses, it's clear that it's within the general 6 months limit. And 6 months is the limit that's put on hospice care. A doctor has to declare that to the best of his knowledge, this patient has only 6 months or less left. And on the basis of that, this patient could then be admitted to hospice care. I think that most everybody has a very good feeling about hospice care. It tends to make it possible for this person to feel. His comment was, I want to be left alone. What he really means is, I want to be myself. I want to be involved in this myself. I don't want doctors sticking me with all kinds of things. Just let me live my life. And hospice would do everything possible to help this man live a meaningful life for the rest of his life. And as I've talked with patients in hospice sections of hospitals, or talked with patients who are on hospice care, but they're back in their homes. Their last months of life are much more meaningful than I have ever noticed in the 40 years I've been involved in this general work in the previous situations where they were doing everything possible up to the very last 2 or 3 weeks. And as you may know, a large percentage of hospital costs are in the last 3 weeks of life. I think they say that 25% of all health costs are spent in the last 3 to 6 weeks of life, which is kind of ridiculous when you think of all the things they do, the heroic measures they try. That is changing beautifully now, and I think that the hospice movement is the most holistic approach I have ever seen in medicine because of all the people involved in trying to make this patient comfortable and allowing the patient to live just as normal a life as ever with in some hospice places with their own dogs or canaries or whatever with them. Families can come in anytime. I sat in on a part of a meal the other night, a few weeks ago, in a hospice setting where the children came in and made the dinner for the mother. And it was just as happy an evening as you could imagine. Now, I want to take just a minute to say that I've just read an article on the other side of hospice. I've taken 4 statements from hospice for how they feel about hospice negatively. And I just want you to know that there are people who oppose the hospice concept. One, he says, this is a PhD, not an MD, assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh. He says, hospice practices may cause some people to die sooner than necessary. And so you have to kind of think of what that means. But what's the word necessary? 2, others might die who could have been cured. The patient in the illustration in our case, the doctor is clear that this patient has no true hope and that all he's doing is to try to do the best he can, which he feels he ought to do. 3, it begins something which has no clear boundaries in time. That is, if we can stop treatment for someone who's given 6 months only or less to live, why not do it for 2 years? What would happen if you said, well, let's do it for anybody that has 2 years to live? The question is, maybe that isn't the thing to do. It happens that the government now, a new bill just came out in 1982, says allows funds for 7 months of hospice care and no more. So it's now limited to 7 months. Should it be extended to 24 months, for instance? And finally, hospice care has too much concern for cost effectiveness. That what we're really trying to do, says this author, is to save money. And if that's what we're doing, we ought to be ashamed of ourselves in America, that we're trying to get people to die sooner so we won't have to spend so much money. That's the other side of the program. Problem.
Okay, from a legal point of view, my experience from the hospital setting that I worked in previously was that there are statements of patients' rights in, I assume, probably every hospital. And the one that I worked with, and I can't quote directly, but basically said that a patient has a right to refuse treatment. Now, that same statement said nothing about other people on behalf of that patient. For instance, then would a wife or a spouse or children then have the right to make that decision about refusing treatment or not? Probably not, at least under the patient's rights statements that I'm familiar with. That would be different, however, if this patient had drawn up a living will. Now, a living will is a general term that refers to a statement that many people have already drawn up that says, I don't want to be hooked up to life-sustaining machines in the event that the doctors decide that I only have a limited time to live. And usually that limited time is not very precisely defined. In most states, I believe, there are laws that define the conditions under which a living will is valid. I can't tell you about what the law is in your state. In Oregon, the requirements for that living will to be valid are that it was drawn up after, or it was signed, after the person discovered that they had a terminal illness. And it is executed in the same manner as a will is executed, with witnesses and those sorts of things, so that those witnesses, the purpose of that is so that later the witnesses could be called in if someone were to contest the validity of the living will. So it becomes, in effect, like a will, but takes effect at the point where the person has a terminal illness, or where a decision is about to be made in terms of hooking a person up to life support systems. One of the questions around that sort of a situation would be whether the person making the living will was competent to do that. And those would be the same questions that would arise if, for instance, a family later would say that any sort of a will, a last will and testament, was valid. The requirement generally is that the person is of, quote, sound mind. And if you could show that the person was not competent, not mentally competent to make that decision at the time that they made it, then the living will would probably not be effective. My opinion in this situation is colored by the fact that my mother had colon cancer, and five years later was discovered to, the colon cancer was treated much in the same way that Roger described, and 5 years later she was discovered to have liver cancer, which killed her within about, I believe, 8 or 9 months. And I personally experienced the trauma that a person in that sort of situation goes through just simply existing. The living was not very pleasant during those 8 or 9 months. She had a great deal of nausea, literally, I don't know, may have come close to starving to death, actually, just because she simply could not keep food in her stomach. She was really miserable. She was unable to do many of the things that made life pleasurable for her. And I bring then that experience to my, what I would counsel a person if they were asking my opinion, what should we do for Father or Mr. T.S. in this kind of situation? Because I can really sympathize with Mr. T.S. as to wanting to die with as much dignity as possible, and not becoming an incredibly dependent child before he died. And that concerns me as a human being. Maybe Roger used the word hope, that it's a doctor's job to sustain life as long as there is hope. It occurred to me when he said that hope means different things for a Christian and a non-Christian person. If Mr. T.S. was firmly convinced that his relationship with God was in the right perspective, it would seem to me a hopeful thing to do that he could die as quickly and as peacefully as possible in this situation. And that may be his hope. And I think that needs to be recognized. It may be that that is a better hope for him than sustaining life under rather miserable conditions.
Beautifully stated. For me to live is Christ, to die is gain.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any comments or questions of clarification or anything before we get into where you personally might agree or disagree? Let's do some clarification type things. Yes?
Yeah. If there's a statement made about a living will being made after the terminal illness was identified, you mean to tell me that all the people who write wills with the notion in mind that if anything horrible happens to them, as far as, say, an automobile accident in which they lose consciousness, that the living will is of no value at all, at least in Oregon. Is that right? If they make a will and then they have a terrible accident in which they lose consciousness and are maybe in a coma.
Now you're saying You're saying will, you're not saying living will. Are you making
living
that
will.
Distinction?
Okay. Living will. That their family could not choose as well to pull plugs or whatever. Is that what you're...
Their family would not have the legal
right.
support to choose to pull the plugs. Yes.
But would the living will take effect if made before the accident?
No,
not in Oregon.
Not in Oregon.
Not in
the
California.
Point is to get that person to California quick.
I've seen in Washington also that living will is legally effective if made at any time if it's made properly.
Ah.
It is.
Okay.
Here, okay, get them
I mean,
to
there
Washington.
There are some questions, you know, in some court cases, but in general in Washington, it is an effective document.
The intention, I suppose, is to say that when I'm feeling well and I write my living will, I have all these fine, noble ideas of how I can handle things. But if I was really in that situation, would I sign the same paper again?
Yes,
and I think that's their motive.
Yes,
but
I assume that's the
but
basis.
With
the
illustration
of the
given, it just doesn't fit at all.
Yeah.
How new is the whole living will thing? Does anybody know?
I don't know when exactly that began to be a thing that people did. I'm generally aware of it for the last, I would say, 10 years or so, but
that's
I don't know.
That's my guess,
too.
Yeah, you?
Well, I was wondering about this living will. My daughter has signed one like that. She lives in Idaho. And her thought was, if she was in a car accident or something, that her organs could be used by someone. She also has that in her.
Mm-hmm.
That was going to be one of my questions, and probably to you, Roger, that if you take the life, or if you let the person die at this earlier stage, would there be more organs or better organs available versus waiting down the road?
Generally speaking, patients who are dying of cancer are not used for transplant organs,
yeah.
just in the chance that you had microscopic metastases at the time you used them. So the transplant problem is almost exclusively related to trauma victims and usually young people. I guess I want to say one thing. One thing is kind of interesting that we frequently talk about how doctors have been considered too omnipotent. But when it comes to a declaration of terminally ill, we don't have any doubt about that. It just takes the word of one physician, essentially, and then all of a sudden we're talking hospice movements, we're talking about abandoning medical care, we're talking about doing that, because that decision is obviously not wrong.
You think we should have a second opinion?
Well, I think it's just as valid there as in any other situation.
You think we move too quickly toward accepting death?
Well, I think there are people who do. And by that, I guess what comes to mind is, unfortunately, I have the experience of dealing with people who are dying of ovarian cancer, more common than colon cancer. And in ovarian cancer victims, it's always a really difficult decision about when to quit intervening. Because ovarian cancer is not merciful enough to get into your liver or get into your brain or get into your lungs where it will kill you rapidly. It produces intestinal obstruction. And intestinal obstructions are, relatively speaking, amenable to surgical treatment. And other organ systems are working all right. So you're always faced with this repetitive problem. Should we go after this obstruction, or should we say this is the last one? We'll quit on this one. And then you never know until you've actually made the incision, looked at the intestines, and seen how bad it is, whether this is going to be an obstruction that can be fixed by a simple little bypass operation, or whether it's an obstruction that is not amenable to surgical treatment. And between the options of having an NG tube down for 9 months while someone who is an American who's pretty well got pretty good nutrition in general is going to last quite a while even with total intestinal obstruction, versus an operation to try to remove that, it's not that easy a question. You know the patient's going to die. You know you're eventually going to lose. There's no doubt about that. But is this an instance in which you should intervene for the sake of comfort, not necessarily prolonging life, or you shouldn't? And many people shake their heads and say, well, Aunt so-and-so has lived a good life, but you don't know how Aunt so-and-so is going to die. And we do. It makes you a little bit less eager to just write them off.
Are you saying in that type of problem that hospice care, which keeps people comfortable and seems to be quite capable of doing it, is not capable of doing it with an ovarian type of problem?
Well, frequently, unless the hospice care is willing to use nasogastric tubes and things like that to prevent the patient from vomiting all the time. So in the case of, again, in hospice care, we so often are luckily working with a patient who is
older,
maybe
71. That's a very young person. I want you to know that.
I wasn't going to say older, but you're talking about younger.
Yeah.
But we're talking about people, at least as I see it, who are capable of basic functions of life, but may be suffering from pain, through which many of the things that the hospice movement has to offer is the perfect management for that kind of problem. But not all cases fall into that description.
Can I go back just briefly to the business about organ donating, before we get off too far from that? In Oregon, at least, it's possible to donate your organs much more easily than it is to have an effective living will. In Oregon, at least, and I don't know about other states, I assume it's not too different, that all you have to do is sign a very nice, neat little card statement that organizations are very happy to provide you with in front of two witnesses and carry it around in your next to your driver's license, and that's an effective donation of your organs. So that part of the living will business is much easier to do.
But that in Minnesota, it's after you're declared technically dead by a physician. Now, ours was right on a driver's license, but it's different from the living will in the sense that I am a donor at the point where a physician declares me as legally dead.
That's right. And that's so different than the living will hook up to life support system.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Related to this?
Just a further clarification, I work in ICU.
A little louder for the people.
I work in intensive care and we do quite a bit of organ procurement, but hospitals for protection for themselves and most physicians will, on top of waiting 24 hours, of course, and for brain death criteria, also have the family, the immediate family, wife, children, or parent, depending on the case, also sign a normal surgical consent or a consent for the organ donation, and so it's not as simple as signing your name. And you don't get a lot of organs because family members may not be aware that the person signed the consent. So
it's important to let your family know that you've done that.
Organ physicians are coping now.
Sure.
Let me just take a sense here. If I heard the three of you, you were basically all saying that you would let this person die. In this case, is that what all three of you were basically saying?
I'm assuming that that's what that person wanted, and okay. That statement let me alone.
Yeah, I just wish he was 91 instead of 7.
Yeah. How many of you out there, if you were the nurses or the doctor there, how many of you would go along? Let's say the nurses were pushing, let's let him die, and the doctor was saying, let's keep him alive a little bit longer. How many of you would tend to go with what you know right now with the nurses? How many of you would tend to go with the doctor? Okay.
One.
The question I have for you then, for both who said yes or no, I spent a little bit of time on this, and then maybe we'll move into something that maybe not as black and white, or maybe this isn't black and white once we get into it.
why would you let this person die? And let's make it a little more personal, maybe. This is your father. Yeah. Or let him live. Okay. Yeah, green shirt.
I'm a family practitioner here in Washington, and my primary criteria on whether or not to treat in a situation like that is what the patient's desire is. We know that he's going to die, and it's just a matter of when. And for that matter, it's true for any patient that you're dealing with. You always lose if you're talking about whether you're saving the patient or not. What I as a physician am doing is providing care to that person if they want it. And I would consider that somebody who would go after a patient and do surgery on them, and that patient didn't want to have it done, and legally this has been done as being guilty of assault and battery. You have to have the patient's consent. Now, in this case, the patient is mentally competent, so he can make that decision. Sometimes you get then into a situation where the patient slips into a coma or becomes mentally incompetent, and then you have other people making those decisions, and then it starts getting very sticky legally. But as far as I'm concerned, if a patient doesn't want to have something done, then that's their decision. I can explain all the options to them and say, if you have this done, you are probably going to live this long. If you don't have it done, you're only going to live this long, and you're going to have these, this and this and this for your symptoms, either case. And then you have to make the decision.
And how you say that will make the decision.
That's right. Although oftentimes they will ask you, what do you recommend? And there it really depends upon what the quality of life is going to be for that person. But in this case, he is actually saying, leave me alone. And in a case like that, I think it's just too clear cut.
Of course, in this case, he was kind of coming in and out of a drowsiness and stuff, and there might be a case that this person was kind of with it and kind of out of it, and what, you know, which is which. And I'm saying that it may be a judgment call, and that's your judgment.
If somebody's telling you that, you would have a hard time proving to somebody else that person was not mentally competent. And I think the burden is on you to prove that they're not competent, rather than saying they're not competent and I'm going to go ahead and do this because this is what I want to do.
Okay. Molly?
Just in the last year, I've been involved in two decisions of that sort. And in the state of California, at least in San Diego, there's tremendous cooperation. When I made the decision, there's no more chemotherapy. That was adhered to. And when I requested hospice appeared immediately. When I requested that there be no tubing or life-sustaining measures made for body, no one did, and she just died quietly at home. And then about 3 months ago, I got a phone call from University Hospital, 5 o'clock in the morning, from doctors for my father. And basically, this young physician was asking about how aggressive should they be. And I said, don't be aggressive, make him comfortable and relieve his pain. And they complied with that. Dad is incredibly resistant and resilient and has been through this for about 12 years running now. So that wasn't new to me. I had to make that decision before. And it's hard, and yet it isn't hard. And I guess what I'm thankful for right now is that someone asked and they complied with my decision as hard as it was to make in both cases.
Legally, are they on shaky ground, do you think?
No. In terms of, I don't know your name, the physician back there said about the burden of proof about whether the person is competent. He's right that the person is assumed competent unless you can show to the contrary. And so he's correct on that.
What What's the legal status in a case where there's no living will, there's more than one daughter or son, and they don't agree?
Mm-hmm. And there is no spouse, is that what you're saying?
Right.
And what is the condition of the person, the patient?
Well, much like this case history.
Well, if that...
One of the children wants to keep the person alive as long as possible, the other one wants to stop heroic measures. What do you do then?
Let's make the person in a coma.
Okay, yes. It would make a difference if the person is in a coma.
Let's put the person in the coma.
If the person's able to make their own decision, then of course that's the person who has the right to make the decision. If they're in a coma, again, our position back there is correct. It becomes much more sticky legally, because then the question is, who has the right to make the decision? And it's very unclear at that, and I don't know. That would be a very difficult situation for the doctor to deal with.
How would a chaplain deal with the two sons or two daughters or daughter and son who come in there and the patient is there, and they one says, let's let Dad die, and the other one says, let's try to keep that person alive?
Well, our intention, of course, is to give them a chance to talk it out. And so we take them to a place where we can sit quietly and talk. And I suppose, without realizing it, we're trying to influence one of them in our direction. There's no doubt about it. And we will probably say this. I guess I can't at the moment think of any case where the person who has objected to our point of view won out.
You were persuasive.
So I don't know what I would have done if they would have. Suppose they do stay at loggerheads. Can you make no decision then?
And that's making a decision then.
Yes, that's making a decision. And I would guess the treatment of the doctor would continue then, the treatment that the doctor was recommending in this situation.
Okay, couple of hands we haven't hit. One, two, and then back there.
I know an example in Dallas of a man who was in kidney failure, and a young South American doctor was up there determined to be the hero of the case and insisted on treating him, and this man wanted to die, and his wife wanted to take him out of the hospital, fly him in an ambulance, fly him back home, and he refused to sign the form to let him out of the hospital.
He wouldn't
give him pain medication to help him leave. They packed him up, boarded the plane, and someone appeared magically in the hall with everything they need. They really thought it was an angel, because the doctor had disappeared. Somehow the patient's form was signed, but he didn't sign it, and he left against his will. He was a 32-year-old who was just determined to control this case.
I took the position that let a person die, but we're talking case law, and so much of the case law revolves around a case where that is kind of ironic, and that's the Kieran Ann Quinlan case. You know, the thing that really brought all this to the attention of the people, and as far as I know, unless she's died in the last couple of months, she's still alive.
Right. Yeah.
Her parents
have
been very active in
hospice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
thank you.
Yeah.
My name is Greg.
Greg, thanks.
The situation you brought up where the families will have a difference of opinion in a comatose patient, most large hospitals now have a policy set up in their bylaws that will make arrangements for that decision to be made. And it usually will consist of the attending physician, one other physician or more on the hospital staff, the chaplaincy staff if they're available, family members, someone from the nursing staff, and legal counsel for the hospital. And they are then empowered to make the decision. This can be taken before a judge then, and the judge ends up making the decision and ends up in court. But that is the situation most large hospitals is that there's a...
consensus, majority rules, or...?
It's usually a majority rules kind of thing, and it's just, it's a panel that is set up ahead of time to deal with situations like that, and they've only been dealt with in the last 3-4 years.
Yes, in fact, the American Hospital Association has just gone on record this past year advocating that every hospital should have what they're now calling an ethics committee,
right,
made up of the people you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I would just like to remind you that two people that I think of just offhand who wanted very much like your friend to die, but were not allowed to die, were Eleanor Roosevelt and President Truman, both of whom pleaded with them to stop the foolishness and did not have the effect to get to stop them, because the heroic methods went on and on and on. And the story of Eleanor Roosevelt is just very sad. Well, so is Truman. That was pretty awful. Week, day after day after day, they kept him alive. I think we are angry enough about that kind of thing that little by little, this is not going to happen. And your experience in San Diego sounds great to me to know that they're now following that.
Has there been any families after the, you know, that have been sued the hospital for those heroic measures or something? Does anybody, you know?
I don't know.
I mean, that might be interesting too. Here and then over here and then over here. 1, 2, 3.
I'm switching directions, but back to the living will. We seem to have a number of questions and interests. I suspect that if we were to, you know, take a hand survey of those who would choose, if we were in that position of personally choosing to extend our life, you know, with all kinds of tubes and stuff, if we were known to be terminally situation, you know, I think very few would not raise their hands. We would say, yeah.
How many would like a living will? How many would not? Okay. How many have a living will? Why don't the rest of you?
I want to say is, before everybody runs out and makes one, it's not that easy.
Yeah.
And there are lots of complications. Now, I'm sure persons have had positive experiences where they say, oh, am I ever glad my mother had this or whatever. I suppose those of you who are closer to it day in and day out could account those. My only experience with a living will has been awful. In a woman who has such a document, and the terms of it are so ambiguous that it has the doctors and the nursing home staff and two shifts of RNs in totally tied up. And she, for 40 years, even when she was in considerably good health, would go through deep periods of depression where she wished to die. And she still occasionally goes through this. And she's non-communicative, and she just sits there, and her daughters analyze from a medical perspective, mother is dying, she is definitely dying, no heroic measures. She also has a very complicated combination of drug treatment that now and then needs to be adjusted under hospital care. Their hands are tied to take her to the hospital, because her daughter comes running in, you're not taking mother to the hospital, she's dying, and she has this living will. And it ties their hands completely, and they're not paying the doctor's bills because they don't think he should be treating her, and, you know, it's just the most bizarre thing. It's maybe extreme, but it's not always ideal, I can assure you.
How long has it gone on this way?
Well, the most current one started, well, it depends on your depression cycles, partly. It started about 6 months or a year ago, and then things sort of leveled out because she got feeling better, and against some judgment, they took her to the hospital and so on. But it's a reoccurring thing. But the daughters are, you know, we're not going to do anything to prolong mother's life. And the nurses say, are we prolonging her life by suggesting she goes to the hospital for some IV treatment until she gets her medication straightened out? It's just not always peaches and cream.
Number two, or that was the number three, and you'd be four and five. And we've got about 10 minutes, so try to keep your comments brief so we can at least get as many people in.
I was just wondering what kind of legal action has been taken about cases that we've been hearing quite a bit of in California, of people who want to take their children from the hospital and who are suffering from, say, leukemia, down to Mexico for lateral treatments, and the hospital refuses to let them go, that sort of thing. And then that just... piggybacking on that is the notion that who's responsible for the decisions concerning the health of a child or a minor, but who is not an infant or a small child? I mean, is that still parental?
Yes, that's still generally parental. Parents have the right to make those decisions until the child is an adult. At whatever age the law of your state says that person is an adult, usually 18, I believe. And there have been cases about that sort of thing where parents have wanted to refuse medical treatment, sometimes because of religious reasons, sometimes because of other kinds of activities. And the courts have generally upheld parents' right to refuse medical treatment in other than critical life-sustaining kind of measures. That's a generalized statement, but maybe it's a short answer to your question.
Anything on the land trail?
I don't know anything specifically about those cases, but in general, you know, with that general background, I would guess those parents have the right to take their children wherever they want to administer whatever kind. It's parents'
they
decision.
Had to steal the child from the hospital, and then they were there were warrants out for their arrest, and that was I don't know whatever was resolved about that, but there was kind of an amnesty to allow the parents to come back into the state so that they would not be tried for the murder of their child, if I'm not mistaken. Gretchen, do you remember that?
Wasn't the child eventually, because of action of the hospital or physicians involved, declared a ward of the court, or
yes,
so that that decision can be made? If you take your child with acute leukemia to Mexico for Laetril, that is tantamount to murder. Because that's a curable disease.
What right do parents have? Yeah, that's a whole other very interesting. But over here was a comment, yeah.
I just finished 9 months of chairing a hospital ethics committee coming up with a statement that Ranger is making reference to. It's a very difficult task. Our basic posture was that with the statement that we have come up with, and it's relatively long, is that we wanted that decision to be made at the lowest possible level. Now, we are a family hospital, and most of the processes that we put in place placed a great deal of emphasis on a family physician conference, that those discussions would go on, including all the people that Granger mentioned. The last thing in the world we wanted, from the perspective of about 9 people on this committee, was to have a judge outside of the hospital, totally removed from the realm, totally removed from the family, making that sort of decision. But I think it's incumbent upon all of us to have conversations with spouses, with parents, whatever, to some way or another help prepare us for that possible decision that has to be made. And then hopefully it can be made within the context of people who know the patient, the family, the brothers and sisters. And my heart goes out to a situation where you have an interfamilial conflict where one isn't agreeing. But the basic posture for our hospital is to keep that decision at the lowest possible level, keep it as close to the patient as we can.
Two more comments, right here, and then right behind you, and then any sort of wrap-ups you people want.
Yeah, I had just one comment. I mean, I think we're all in agreement when a person has lived a full life, or a reasonably full life, has become a cognitive person and understand. But what about children? What are parents? I mean, why should parents have the right to decide whether or not a child should live or die in a case like a spina bifida baby, where the chances are the baby may die but could survive and could lead a reasonably good life? And I think that's the baby Doe case that they're talking about. Parents want the child to die. They don't want to deal with it. The courts have stepped in because doctors and competent medical people have said that child has a chance. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is an issue we should have taken up earlier, one controversy.
Thank you.
I'd like to reemphasize what you just said over here about talking to other people in your family and not relying on a living will. Most of the time when you get into trouble, if it's a rapid trouble, the living will isn't going to be found, first of all. And secondly, there is some legal question about it in some states. So if you have a family physician or a regular physician, talk to them about it if you get a chance, because that is going to be the most powerful factor that's going to make that decision later. The other thing is to talk to your family about it and really let them know how you feel, and then know exactly what you're talking about. whether you're talking about a terminal illness that you suddenly got slipped into and you can't make the decision, or an acute situation. I had a case just a few months ago in a 48-year-old man who he and his wife had talked this all over, and he's a severe asthmatic, and he had said, I don't want to be on a respirator, I don't want to be on life support, all this kind of stuff, and they had agreed on that. Well, he went home one night, had a severe drug reaction to penicillin, and had a respiratory arrest, and his wife was there trying to fight off the paramedics, saying, we don't want anything done, because we talked about this. And, you know, more or less, they removed her from the scene, and, you know, this person's perfectly fine now. So you have to know what you're talking about. You really have to know what you talk about it in a serious situation. Talk about it with your doctor, maybe with the family present.
In terms of the question here that was raised about decisions for children and so forth, my understanding is that several of the members of the panel are going to be here next week, and we're interested in perhaps doing an act two Granger's.
And I would like to say, because we do have Tom Witt's concert starting immediately at 10 o'clock, which is in 3 minutes, I'm going to say there has not been a forum in the 3 weeks here that we've ever resolved anything. The point of the forum is to get you people to start talking to each other and with some key people out here and with these people further about this issue, thinking about it yourself. God bless you all. Let's go to a concert and go to bed.